Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the General Government and Transportation Committee. It's Thursday, February the 1st, by golly, it's going fast, we're having fun, year 2001, and welcome to Hearing Room 343. And what I'd like to do at this time is open up an informational meeting, and I understand we have agreement from the folks who will be presenting information on the different modes to allow Bob Russell, Dee Bridges, and Al Elkins, representing trucking, to go first. Now, I think actually truckers have to stop at railroad crossings, so it was pretty gracious of railroads to allow them to do that. Without objection, why don't you guys come on forward? While we're waiting here, we have former Representative Bob Montgomery in the audience, and we have also several of our realtors from parts of my district and areas nearby with us. Welcome, glad to have you here. And what we're doing right now, this is part of the informational series to make sure that the committee has a view of where the different modes are headed and what their thoughts are relative to their part of the transportation story. With that, I will open that hearing, informational meeting, and let you guys decide who's going first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Bob Russell, Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Trucking Associations, and with me is Al Elkins and Dee Bridges. And they've volunteered me to go first this afternoon. What I'd like to start with is sort of just to give you a little snapshot of what the trucking industry is. Nationally, trucking employs over 9 million people, which is more than the populations of 42 out of the 50 states. So trucking is a very significant industry nationally. We carry 60% of all freight moving in this country, and we collect 82 cents of every dollar that's spent on transportation, which means that we're a fairly high-cost mode in comparison to some of the others. In Oregon, we employ about 110,000 people, which is one out of every 11 workers. We pay $3.6 billion in wages, and our wage average is $32,609 per employee, which is a family living wage. In Oregon, we move 87% of all the freight that moves within the state. We serve all the communities in Oregon, and over 70% of all Oregon communities are only served by truck. We like to say that if you've got it, a truck brought it. For obvious reasons, the trucking industry is very concerned about highway safety, and we are very proud of our record in recent years. Nationally, truck miles of travel have increased by 40%, yet the fatal accident rate has dropped by 35%. We think that trend is going in the right direction. In Oregon, total truck crashes have dropped from 146 in August of 1999 to 58 in August of 2000. During the same period, truck at fault crashes dropped from 100 to 28. So again, we're making fairly dramatic improvements in highway safety, at least as it concerns trucks in Oregon. While a single fatality is too many, we continue to work to make our highways safer, and any ideas that this committee comes up with, we'd love to work with you to make trucking and highway safety in general better. We wanted to talk briefly about the issues that we see facing the legislature this session in terms of transportation and trucking. Our agenda is not large by any means. Matter of fact, we're hoping to keep our head down and sort of stay out of the way this session. Highway funding is and continues to be a major issue facing our state. We're only too well aware of that as we make our living off the highways. We don't have the answer today. We're still dealing with our frustrations over the failure of Measure 82. If we're more than willing to work with the committee on any proposals that you might have to help improve our highways, that's a major concern to us. But again, we don't know what to do at this point, so we're open to suggestions. In terms of the weight mile tax, we've got some good news. We do not intend to propose changing the weight mile tax to a diesel fuel tax and registration fee system this session. As many of you are very well aware, the American Trucking Associations filed a lawsuit against the state contending that Oregon's weight mile tax was discriminatory. We'd like to let that lawsuit run its course before we discuss the future with the legislature again, and it's unlikely that there will be any resolution of that lawsuit during this session. Those are really the things that are on our mind, and I'd like to give Dee and Al an opportunity to talk, and then we'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have copies of the information you just presented, or could you get it to us?
Sure. Absolutely.
We're going to transcribe it, too. We were just talking about it.
This is the second or third time we've done this, and Bob usually starts his presentation out by saying, "We are trucks." So he kind of threw me there because he didn't say it. So, "We are trucks."
Now, wait a minute. I think I'm only CDL licensed person here.
I am Dee Bridges, for the record, Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association. I'm executive director, and I guess IR log trucks and chip trucks and lumber trucks and plywood trucks and veneer trucks. We have about 300 members, and we, too, have a very small agenda. We, Bob alluded to a couple of things that we're interested in, the highway cost allocation study that has to be dealt with or received and something done with as it comes to this this body, and we'll have some things to say about that at an appropriate, sort of at the appropriate time.
Dee, can I interrupt you for 1 second? We have, the senator is CDL licensed, current, you had been recently drug tested?
Not recently, but
okay. And we have a former professional truck driver here, so we're with you.
And I had a toy truck as a child.
All right.
I actually own two over-the-road trucks that I leased to my son-in-law, so I guess I are also highway trucks, but I don't have a CDL or anything close to it. I think I have a motorcycle endorsement on my driver's license. I haven't used it in 25 years. Flat fees will be coming up. We, my members are probably, I know that Bob has several members that are flat fee payers. The majority of those, I think, probably are my members. And that study is going to be coming to the committee or coming to the legislature, and we'll have some things to say about it, too. The only other thing that we have that I've taken on kind of as a personal chore is a little fix to a bill that occurred last session, a noble idea that had to do with a one-stop shop for overdimensional permits. So instead of having to call 36 counties to get a permit to go through their county with an overdimensional permit, this was an idea where you could just go one place to get it. Great idea. The devil was kind of in the details, and it had some unintended consequences, and we were trying to fix those unintended consequences, and are confident that we'll be able to do that.
Dee, I'll just let you know, when I ran in the door just 1 minute before the committee was to start, I just left Joan's office, Joan Robinson's office, and that one is just about complete, so you'll get to see it soon.
Senator George has graciously agreed to sponsor that bill for us, so.
Maybe a committee bill if I could talk him into it.
Yes.
Oops, here we go again.
This room had that problem.
Does it? Okay.
I thought that was me.
Hi, my name is Al Elkins. I'm representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association. First of all, I'd like to thank Mr. Balducci for going the extra mile setting us up today. Appreciate it. We are an organization of small one truck and multiple truck owners. And we have a few issues that will be coming before you today, this session. One of them has to do with the unclaimed or abandoned vehicles that we're dealing with, and we're working with Senator Fisher's office. And we're also working with Department of Motor Vehicles and Oregon State Police and making that a workable solution for all parties involved. So we'll have that bill before you sometime here shortly. That concludes anything I have to add or would like to add.
Any questions?
Yeah, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about, Bob, the significant reduction in truck accidents over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. I was curious about what do you think are the major contributing factors to the safety improvement there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, there's a number of things. Certainly, those of us in the industry recognize that safety is simply good business. Our insurance companies also recognize that safety is good business, and they have been working more closely with us than they have in the past to help us improve our safety of operations. Certainly in Oregon, the Motor Carrier Transportation Branch, which is responsible for enforcing safety regulations in the state, has done an outstanding job. They work in concert with the Federal Highway Administration. They sort of have concurrent jurisdiction over truck safety, and they're both enforcing the regulations in Oregon. But I would certainly like to particularly compliment the Motor Carrier Transportation Branch. They do an outstanding job, and they are known nationally for their safety initiatives with trucks. So I think it's all of those things sort of together, given the economic climate, wherever we can save money, and certainly by reducing accidents, we save money. That's helped a lot.
Mr. Chairman Sullivan,
yes.
Are you familiar with the House bill that is out regarding the farm plate trucks, where the federal government, and this is why I asked the safety question, Mr. Chair, is threatening to withhold $4 million for the safety inspection program unless Oregon includes the farm-plated trucks into the safety program. And there's a bill to repeal that in order to protect those funds. And the farm, of course, truck folks are having a work group, I guess, apparently. I don't know if you're a part of that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Metzger, that particular issue, we have been working with that for some time. At first blush, it appears to be a significant issue, but when you sort of peel away the onion and look at what's really there, what the federal government is trying to assert is a very little piece of jurisdiction. All they're saying is that they have the ability to inspect farm trucks on highway. My understanding is that the Federal Highway Administration in Washington has been working with Oregon's congressional delegation, and there's a solution in the works.
Great.
And I don't expect that to be a major issue this session.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Bob, I'll continue that question. Right now, they must have the ability, because I can remember being pulled through the inspection in Washington State. Are we getting an echo out of that? Oh, okay. Maybe we'll step back away from it a little bit. So apparently that if a farm truck, because I rolled in there with F plates on the truck and was pulling the low bed with a tractor on it, and they sent me in for an inspection. In fact, found a cracked rim on that trailer that day. So they must have the ability to do it right now, but apparently only on the basis of they suspect that there's a problem.
Mr. Chairman, each state's regulations differ somewhat as regard to the farm community. Right now, the federal government, in fact, does have the jurisdiction to do a safety inspection of a farm truck. But we have an exemption in Oregon statute that precludes the Department of Transportation from inspecting those trucks. That's really the issue.
Okay.
Each state, as you know, deals with it differently. Some states have jurisdiction over farmers, and some don't.
Well, there was, over the weekend, I know you're all aware, that we lost a driver and a load of petroleum product on Highway 20. And I believe it was Monday or Tuesday, Coastal Caucus. Alan Brown and I had arrived at the same conclusion. The reason for the accident, in addition to ice, was the road. That section of road from Eddyville up to Toledo was so horrible that when I came around the corner, as I left Eddyville, I thought, where is the accident? And I said, the accident will be right here. And I came around the corner, and that's where it was. So it is critical, as far as continuing to reduce our number of crashes, that we have a highway system that is adequate to handle the truck traffic. But there's that's more of a statement, but I would like to get to a question. One of the problems we had with that accident was it occurred at 2:00 in the morning, and it was 7 before anyone was given access to the actual truck. In other words, the cab just burned until that time. And the reason was is that there was no way to know what was in the trailers, and therefore they wouldn't allow anyone to go up and even fight the fire. If you remember the meeting we had at Woodburn, we had a fellow who was a former driver came in and did that presentation about having that bright packet with that information on in the cab as currently required and in the rear of the trailer. I thought about that several times and thought, well, if it had been present here, they would have immediately gone up, grabbed the packet out, and been able to take a look because the fire was not endangering, you know, catching the trailers on fire. Have you guys had a chance to think about that? The cost would be minimal. This would be only for trucks hauling hazardous materials.
Mr. Chairman, today, under the current regulations, whenever we are hauling hazardous materials, we're required to placard the vehicle. You see the diamond-shaped placards with the number in the center, and that indicates what type of product it is. And that has to be on all four sides and on all sides of all the trailers that are involved. And you're absolutely correct. There's also a requirement for shipping documents in the cab of the truck that identifies the material that's being transported, what it is, and what it's the hazards it represents. Those are already existing federal regulations. Certainly that situation was very tragic. It was one of my members, actually one of their trucks, that was involved. And the president of the company is actually still down there, working and trying to help mitigate the environmental concerns that are going on with that particular accident. So I haven't really had an opportunity to talk to him in terms of what caused the accident, nor have I had an opportunity to talk to him of why people weren't given access to the accident for such an extended period of time. That's really puzzling and quite frankly very troubling. My members frequently talk to me about situations like that, where there is an incident on the highway and either the highway is closed or blocked off or all kinds of things that is sort of inexplicable to them. They don't know why that occurs, and in talking to folks at the Department of Transportation, and part of it is you've got multiple agencies that have jurisdiction once there's an accident. You've got the law enforcement agencies that have jurisdiction and they can do certain things. You've got the road authority that has jurisdiction and they can do certain things. And sometimes it's not real clear who's doing what to whom. And I think that's when you get into these situations like this, where there wasn't access to the accident for such an extended period of time. The placards, I saw pictures of the accident, and certainly the trailer survived.
Yes.
And the placards would have been plainly visible, and the UN number, which is that number in the center, would have been there, and they could have been able within seconds to tell what was on that truck. So
the placards were clearly visible in the pictures, because I was there, you know, following the accident. And one issue, I want to alert you guys to it and be thinking about this, and if you can help us out, it would be greatly appreciated. Beginning next Tuesday, we have some bills coming before the general government portion of this committee. And we'll be talking about seismic preparedness, and these are Peter Courtney's bills. But from that, we're also going to use it as a springboard to look at our preparedness from, you know, what should have happened with the new Carissa to what should have happened here on Highway 20. And other spills have apparently been handled similar to this. I became very frustrated by Sunday afternoon as to how we were reacting to this. So any suggestions to make this system react more efficiently will be greatly appreciated. So if you'd alert your membership, have them, anything that they've noticed, any suggestions that they have, we're going to probably have a series of meetings over the next, say, 60 days, whenever we can fit one in with our schedule, that we'll be dealing with this preparedness. And I found it amazing that it was not until your members' equipment showed up that there was really any booms in the water, other than one that the local, I forgot who it was. But anyway, there was one small boom brought. The additionals were brought by the privates. And so I think we need to look at this issue. Any further questions? Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad you brought this issue up, because I've been concerned for some time with how accidents are handled, both from the state police point of view and from ODOT's. In some cases, merchandise is inaccessible to the owner or to the insurance company until it's totally wasted. In other cases, the truck is actually blocking the road, and I understand that ODOT has the authority to literally shove it off over the bank if they within so many hours or something. So I think this is an issue that we really need to delve into. Also, how the investigations are handled, and if the owner has an opportunity and the insurance company has a chance to come in and investigate the accident while it's hot, or if they have to come in when it's many hours or days later to do their investigation. So I think it's a huge issue that we need to look into. But I also compliment the industry for reducing your record, and I know you worked hard on it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And right now, we would like to hear the history and evolution of the Oregon Short Line Railroads. Bob Nobo, Oregon Short Line Rail Association. I'll ask each, all three of you to, when you speak, I'll let you determine who's going to go in what order, and then I, identify yourself for the record, and begin with your...
Well, I'm going to start, Chair George. My name is Bob Melbo, and I'm the president of the Oregon Short Line Railroad Association, and to my right here is Walt Brickridell from Central Oregon and Pacific. And to my far right is David Root of the Willamette Valley Railway, and they each will also talk here and tell you a little bit about their businesses today. My objective is simply to give you an overview of the short line industry in the state. We have made available some written material about our industry, including a brochure that was put out last year on Oregon's short lines. And that brochure includes a map of the smaller map of this, of the map that's over here on the easel, so for your own closer inspection, just a little hard to see this map because the short lines are, by their nature, so small, and the state is so large. But anyway, the information we have, I'm not going to duplicate that in my testimony because you can peruse that for, you know, at your own leisure. Short lines have always been a part of the situation, the transportation situation in Oregon, but they have really grown in number and in miles operated in the last 20 years since the passage of the Staggers Act in 1980, which deregulated the railroad industry. Prior to the Staggers Act, there were something like 45 large railroads in the United States, and now that number is down to about 4 very large railroads, but at the same time, there's been a more than a doubling in the number of short lines from around 200 and some at that time to well over 500 today. This is because the big railroads have been successful in their strategy to spin off branch lines and marginal lines to short line operators. And this has actually been a good thing because otherwise I believe many of those lines would have been abandoned had the larger railroads not had the ability to dispose of them to small operators. While there was some short line growth in Oregon during the 1980s, immediately following the passage of the Staggers Act, the real boom did not occur here until the 1990s. And at that time, the short line mileage in the state then grew from a very small percentage to the point where it is today, which is about half of the rail mileage in our state is operated by short lines. Oregon is kind of unique among the states. The average is more like about 30% in most states under short line operation, but Oregon has a significantly higher number of rail miles being run in short lines than do most states. The ownership of short lines in Oregon varies from large corporations. For instance, Central Oregon and Pacific is owned by Rail America, and the Willamette and Pacific and Portland and Western are operated by Genesee and Wyoming. And then we have very small operators, such as Dave Root down here at the end of the table, who essentially owns his own railroad. And then we also have some publicly owned railroads. The Port of Tillamook Bay Railroad is owned by the Port of Tillamook Bay. The City of Prineville is in the railroad business, and so is Lake County, which owns a line from Alturas, California, up to Lakeview. An Oregon county is kind of unique, owns, there's about two-thirds of that line is in the state of California, but nevertheless, that line is owned by the county of Lake. So We have sort of their gamut from large corporations down to very small individual family operations and some public ownership as well. The short lines today serve about 60% of the rail customers, the users, that is, in the state, those who either ship or receive products by rail. In that respect, the short lines very much operate as a retailer of the larger railroad services and to provide the pickup and delivery service, so to speak, and while the bigger railroads, and of which there are now just two, Union Pacific and the Burlington Northern and Santa Fe, provide the what I would call a wholesale transportation service, taking the cars for the long haul across the country. The rail service does allow many of our Oregon businesses to compete in markets that they otherwise might find difficult to compete in if they did not have rail transportation. And it also allows Oregon to consume products from other states that might not otherwise be affordable if they could not move in by rail. The short lines today have got what's really unique about the short line industry today is that they have taken lines, branch lines that were heretofore under diverse ownership and have in some cases tied these together under single ownership, making possible the intrastate, in other words, local movement of traffic, whereas before the larger railroads, for the most part, have the philosophy used to be that if it wasn't going to go 500 miles or more, it belonged on a truck. But the short lines today have a much different philosophy about that. And in fact, Central Oregon and Pacific is hauling logs and is hauling veneer over short distances. Portland and Western is hauling rock for Morse Brothers for 23 miles from a quarry northwest of Salem. Up to the Wilsonville area, and in fact, last year carried some 800,000 tons of rock by rail and taking some 30,000 trucks off of Interstate 5 as a result of that. So the short line industry is very hungry for traffic and as a result is interested in the so-called short hauls that the big railroads were really not interested in when they had these properties. Unfortunately, many of the lines were acquired with a deferred maintenance deficit left by their predecessors, and the overall dynamics of the business haven't really changed in that short lines are still basically low-density operations and do not have, in many cases, the volume of traffic needed to cover the relatively high level of fixed cost associated with railroading. So the deferred maintenance deficits have been difficult to deal with and in some cases have been impossible to deal with because the lines simply do not generate enough revenue to allow the operator to properly improve the property. In that regard, the federal government recently passed a program of railroad infrastructure funding, which is attractive to the short lines, except for one major flaw. It requires a credit risk premium payment up front, which in many cases could be 10 or 15% of the total amount. And as one short line operator characterized to me, was that if he had the $500,000 necessary to borrow the $5 million, he wouldn't need to borrow the $5 million. So that's one major problem with the current federal program is that the credit risk premium is still a pretty hefty number for the small railroads to pay up front in order to get the government loan. The second drawback of that particular program is that it does require a good business case to borrow the money in the first place, and so that program really is of no use on those lines where traffic is so marginal that the future of the branch or the line is threatened. And if it's needed to be part of the state infrastructure, then another type of funding mechanism is going to be necessary in order to perpetuate it, because while it may pay off in the future, it's the problem in most cases is now in terms of the condition of the line. Case in point is the line down from Corvallis down to Dawson, where Hull Oaks Lumber Company is. That line received some e-board money last year, $250,000, which will be enough to keep it going for at least another year, but the overall fundamental problem remains about how to effectively fix that line up so that it could be a self-sustaining proposition. Well, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Walt Brickridell, let him talk a little bit about Central Oregon and Pacific.
Thank you. Chairman George, Vice Chairman Metzger, members of the Government and Transportation Committee, my name is Walt Brickridell, and I am assistant to the General Manager of Central Oregon and Pacific Railroad. My remarks here today is a summary of what has been handed out to you and in this testimony, so I won't belabor you by going through the whole thing, although I see that Senator Messerle is way far ahead of me, so thank you, sir. We're the largest of the 19 short line railroad companies in the state of Oregon, with 387 miles of track in southwestern Oregon. We also have another 63 miles in Northern California, serving over 70 customers at more than 100 locations. We're unique in that we depend upon the forest products industry, which make up about 91% of all of our car loadings. In 1995, the first year of our operations, we handled 31,000 carloads. Last year, we achieved in excess of 45,500 carloads. That's a 46% growth since 1995. Employment on our railroad also increased from 75 employees in 1995 to 118 today. Unfortunately, as Bob mentioned, the rail system that we inherited to handle this growing traffic volume was in a state of disrepair, and maintaining such a large system continues to be a challenge. Each year, we pour in approximately $2 million in capital improvements to our infrastructure, and that is excluding routine maintenance. These are improvements. And we do that in order to raise the track speed up to 25 miles per hour. We're certainly not there yet. And also to improve rail service to our customers, obviously. And this commitment, excuse me, to our customers was evident very early when Central Oregon Pacific Railroad, only 6 months into its operation in mid-1995, reopened 85 miles of railroad between Ashland and Black Butte, California, a line that had been closed by the former Southern Pacific for some years. While operationally difficult and costly, our railroad wanted to provide our shippers with a southern gateway so that they can get their product to their customers in a more timely manner. And they have rewarded the railroad with increased business ever since. I'd like to share with you two examples. One was a proposal in late 1995 to haul logs by rail 214 miles from Weed, California, on our line to a sawmill near Roseburg. These were logs that were moving by truck. Attached to the testimony that I provided you is a map of our rail system, and as I refer to some of these points, you can get a pretty good picture of the area that I'm referring to. Major investments were made by the customer in new track at both locations, while the railroad invested in equipment acquisitions, hiring new employees, and we made some operational changes. In the first year alone, 2,100 carloads of logs moved on rail, removing over 7,300 truckloads from Interstate 5. This was the first time that logs had been shipped by rail since Southern Pacific abandoned any log movements in southwestern Oregon some 10 years earlier. Today we move logs for four other customers as well, three of whom have also added tracks to their own facilities, which is counter to a trend in the rail industry that today seems prone to removing tracks. We now handle 4,200 carloads of logs per year, and that's an equivalent of nearly 15,000 trucks. And from sources as far away as Washington State, British Columbia, and Alaska. Our customers tell us that we made rail service competitive with truck, allowing them to obtain their raw materials now from greater distances. Another recent example, more recent example, is the partnership we forged with a company who was moving over 3,600 truckloads of veneer annually from its plant in Yreka, California, to its plywood mills in Medford and Grants Pass. These are only 58 and 91 highway miles, respectively, from Yreka. The railroad again invested in equipment, and the customer added new track in Yreka specifically for this move. And now an estimated, last year we moved 623 carloads in the 11 months of 2000, and an estimated 1,000 carloads of veneer will move this year. All of that previously moved by truck. Both of these programs, incidentally, were recognized nationally by the rail industry by awarding Central Oregon and Pacific Railroad its Excellence in Marketing Award in 1997 and again in the year 2000. But so far, I've talked only about one of our rail lines. The other one, between Eugene and Coquille, deserves greater attention. This 135-mile segment called the Coos Bay Line serves the only deep water port in the south of Portland, as well as communities that for too long have taken an economic back seat to those located on the I-5 corridor. Unfortunately, the Coos Bay Line also suffers from need. About 65 to 70% of this line is rated at less than 25 miles per hour. And additionally, 15% of our business, or 6,700 carloads, is generated from this line each year. In addition to the international port of Coos Bay, we serve 17 customers on this line. Because of its geographic location, it's often subjected to mudslides and flooding. During the winter of 96 and 97 alone, this line sustained over $700,000 in storm damage. And we had to suspend rail service to our customers for up to 2 weeks in some locations. Over 100,000 new ties need to be replaced, and the entire line resurfaced in order to prevent washouts and avoid similar losses in the future. The Coos Bay Rail Bridge, linking the port of Coos Bay and its rail users.
Yes, can I interrupt you for a second? Would you define resurfaced for us so we understood that completely?
Yes, Senator George, member of these committees. Resurfacing means laying ballast and going over with a surfacing machine to smooth it out and bring it down to a particular grade. As you see, when you see railroad tracks, they tend to go down. What that does is help stabilize the ties. It allows for adequate moisture, so flooding and washouts wouldn't occur. The Coos Bay Rail Bridge, which links the port of Coos Bay and its rail users to the rest of the railroad, is also in major need of a rehabilitation. But fortunately, through the efforts of Congressman Peter DeFazio, $5.5 million is now earmarked for that rehabilitation, and the port is seeking the required matching funds. The necessity for funding was driven by the urgent need to improve the economic and industrial outlook for the port and the communities of North Bend, Coos Bay, and Coquille. With the bridge rehabilitation now imminent, it's ever more pressing for us to rehabilitate this Coos Bay line to Eugene. And that's why, as Bob mentioned, we've laid the groundwork to apply for a $6 million loan from the Federal Railroad Administration under its new Railroad Rehabilitation and Improvement Financing Program. This infrastructure improvement will allow us to meet the safety standards set by the FRA to operate at 25 miles per hour, and it will improve rail service to our customers, help stimulate future economic development and industrial growth that will obviously benefit those communities that we serve. Our customers have responded to our plan very positively. Georgia Pacific, for one, is now planning to construct a new track near its lumber mill in Coos Bay that will enable them to ship wood chips by rail for the first time from Coos Bay to their paper mill in Toledo, Oregon, on the Willamette and Pacific, another short line. So here we'll have two short lines working very closely together on this move. Over 500 carloads are projected for the first year alone. Unfortunately, one of the criteria of the FRA's loan program is that credit risk premium that Bob Melbo talked about, which must be paid up front to the FRA prior to even obtaining the loan. This premium, Bob mentioned, could be as much as 10% or 15% of the loan amount. And frankly, Central Oregon and Pacific can't afford to pay this premium. If we had $600,000, we wouldn't be applying for the loan.
You're the okay. It's not going to happen.
We have always stepped up to the plate with significant private dollars to maintain and preserve a system that our previous owners have neglected. However, over the long term, we recognize that we must make capital improvements on this Coos Bay line if we're going to continue to serve these rural communities that so desperately need rail service. And that's why I'm here. I'm asking your committee to exercise whatever your influence with other legislators to consider ways, however innovative or creative, to find funding for light density rail projects such as ours. For our part, it's not the $6 million that we're asking the legislature to fund. We will build our case to secure the FRA loan. It's the $600 credit risk premium, this amount that we can't afford but must put up front just to get the ball rolling. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, thank you for all the efforts that you've been doing in that area. That is a critical part of Oregon that has certainly been depressed, has a lot of opportunity, but needs the services in order to actually maximize its potential. And the investments that have been made there are really appreciated and your tenacity in going after it. I had a couple questions about the request. First of all, on the premium, is this like a loan fee? I mean, it doesn't money that comes back, right? Is this like an upfront cost that is not refundable, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
According to the program, Senator Metzger, it's supposed to fund this revolving railroad rehabilitation fund. And because it's called a credit risk premium, it's there to help offset losses in the event those who are loaned money default on their payments.
Okay.
So it's very, very unlikely that it would be returned.
Is it with that fee then? Is it paid if you do not get the loan? Is that money refundable then? Is it In other words, you have to pay that in order to, you know, get the FRA loan going. But if for any reason that loan is not made, is that money refundable at that point?
If the loan is not made, then that credit risk premium does not have to be paid.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. That answers that question. The third question is, do you have a bill in for that to meet that need request in the legislature currently?
I believe we do not.
Okay. I was wondering, Mr. Chair, because I think that, you know, we've talked about the needs of investing in transportation before, and this is one area of the state that there's been some things done with the casino and other things to try and generate economic interest, but this is a core group of resources there where we have a lot of local investment and commitment that, you know, we've gone so far with the federal government and with the local port there, that I think anything we can do to help provide that will be critical. And whether that's talking to the Oregon Economic Community Development Department, where that might be, or maybe even looking at some bonding to provide that seed capital, I think the return in terms of economic development is just unparalleled for what this would do for the community and be returned in kind to the state. So I want you to know, I know because Senator Messer isn't here at the moment, and I've spent a lot of time this last summer in Coos Bay and Coquille, and I saw your line, and you know, you have my support. I know you have the chair's support, and maybe we can work together to find a way to provide that so that we can get that project going, because you've made a strong investment in that community, in that rail line and servicing, and mm-hmm. I think we need to go the extra mile there.
We'll see if you have an extra bill that you can do, or we'll look for a
relating. I'll see what I can do. Well, he's taken up all the bill slots, so yeah. I'll have to come up with
I'll look for a relating clause. And
there you go.
Senator, thank you very much.
Well, with a few, we'll bear with us, and Senator, if it's okay with you, we've kind of our own in-house expert on some of these things, and Patrick, why don't you go ahead? I'm going to ask you to inform us about what you know about this program,
Okay.
because apparently you've worked on it.
Yeah, Mr. Bricknadel, you've happened to have fallen into a category that I know happen to know a lot about. I helped to develop the TIFIA program for the Federal Highway Administration. That's the highway and intermodal equivalent of RRIF. And so I just had a couple of questions, and I must say that Senator Metzger, you certainly got right to the point there with your questions, and that covers most of my concerns. I know that RRIF, when it was designed, I thought that the Office of Management and Budget had effectively killed the program with their credit risk premium and some of the other portions that they built into it. And you're right, that's interest rate subsidies if provided and any default risk associated with the provision of the loan. And so I was surprised to hear that you're interested in submitting an application there. And I guess my first question was getting at what Senator Metzger got to, which was, were you interested in finding a public sponsor to provide that upfront subsidy? And I got your answer there. But here's my second question. You talked about a 10% subsidy rate, but there, I would assume that there actually hasn't been any credit risk analysis performed by FRA yet. So that's a speculative estimate of what the credit risk premium would be?
Yeah. Chair George, Patrick, that's correct. Excuse me. That's correct. The credit risk premium, the analysis hasn't been done yet. Pardon me.
They're going to bring you a glass of water.
I do have one.
Do you have water?
If I could interject here while you can see this is an emotional issue for Walt, but my understanding of the program is that, of course, the credit risk premium varies
from project to project.
From project to project, and it depends a lot on what kind of collateral mm-hmm. the short line can put up. But on track projects, it's difficult to get much collateral because, you know, when you're putting in ties, let's say you're replacing one out of every three ties, and so that'd be like 1,000 ties per mile. You know, to use those ties as collateral is difficult because most lending institutions, you know, don't have something that they can readily repossess.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is that most short lines have already leveraged everything to the hilt. Anyway, so they don't really have a lot of property around that they can use for new collateral. So that's The credit risk premium will vary depending on just how good of the collateral you have, but our expectation is it's probably going to be in the range of 10% or greater.
Mr. Melville, I can tell you, I'm working on TIFIO. I'm still working on the implementation team for that on the weekends. That it's really the repayment source that's the driving factor of the subsidy that's assigned by OMB. So the stronger the pledge, the lower the credit risk premium, for sure.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Patrick?
Yes.
Patrick, let me ask you a question, and we'll just ignore the guests that we have here today. If, in fact, we were to figure out a way to come up with the $600,000 to go in there, would they value that as, in other words, the state is basically buying into the concept of maintaining and enhancing this rail?
Mr. Chairman, I can only answer from the TIFIA program because, to my knowledge, RRIF hasn't executed any loan agreements. I could be wrong. But from the TIFIA standpoint, absolutely, if there's a state buy-in, especially financially, and there have been some projects that offered significant investments on the part of the state, it certainly does two things. First of all, it demonstrates state and local buy-in, which gets you over the hump as far as litigation and liability requirements in the permitting processes. And then secondly, state funding sources are certainly viewed as a very secure pledge. And both of those combined certainly improves, and it is a competitive process, so it improves the credit quality of the project, reduces the credit risk premium, and then also raises its likelihood that it'll be selected by the federal government.
Okay. As you saw, there was a little negotiation going on up here. And what we're talking about is Vice Chair Metzger is going to accept responsibility to examine this with Patrick's help, and so we would call upon you to join with us to tell us where you think we are, and we'll see if we can't find some mechanism to make this work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, I'd just suggest maybe you discuss this when I was out of the room, but this certainly seems to me like an economic development issue as well.
That's exactly where we're heading. Yes, sir. Appreciate that.
Chairman George, Vice Chairman Metzger, and members of the committee. My name is David Root, and I'm the president of the Willamette Valley Railway Company. It's a family-owned company in the Willamette Valley. We're located here in Marion County. Our line goes from Woodburn out through Mount Angel, Silverton, out through Pratham, up through Almsville, and over to Staten. We're about 32 miles long. It, again, is a spinoff from the Southern Pacific back in 1993. Our customers on our line include Woodburn Fertilizer, AgriFrozen Foods, which I think all of you know is going out of business shortly, which creates a problem for us since they are one of our customers. We have Americold, Smucker's, Willamette Industries, Mount Angel Beverage, Wilco Farmers, Norpac, and Trust Joyce. And Trust Joyce is part of Weyerhaeuser, and they have their large plant up here in Staten. Our track conditions on the line when we took this over from the Southern Pacific was in very poor shape. Like most of the lines in Oregon that were not the main lines, the only time they did any work on them was when there was a derailment. And then they would fix what's there and then forget the rest of it. We have sections out here that haven't had any ties put in probably 40 years at all. So it makes a big difference. We're in the position right now of actually rebuilding the line as much as we can with the revenues that we derive. To keep the line open beyond gear, which is out here at the extension of State Street, we entered into an agreement with Trust Joyce, with Norpac, and with Wilco Farmers, who are the three customers up at Staten, to where they're paying additional $200 a car to raise $400,000 to do additional rehabilitation of that part of the line. To give you an idea, the rail up there is 62 pounds per yard. So if you hear the term about the weight of rail, the main lines out here are normally about 132 or 136 pounds. So that's per yard. This line was 62 pounds, and it was no way laid with the idea of the weight of the cars that we're carrying over today. We are trying to replace that rail, but it's because of the fact that they're paying us the money each month, it's very difficult to do the work ahead of time. And as it is, we've borrowed as much as the bank will let us to do work ahead of times. One of the things that we as a railroad, and I know a lot of the short lines in Oregon are looking at, is trying to get ourselves under maybe this rural development fund that the governor's pushing, and maybe something through economic development, and not so much asking for a handout as much as a loan program. This federal program for like our company is almost impossible to get under. One is the risk premium is going to be so high because our collateral is just not there, and it's a very difficult situation. And if we can actually borrow the money now, do the work, and then pay it back with the funds that are generated on a yearly basis, those type of programs would work real good. We have a very difficult time going to our bank and getting additional money because they just won't do it. So I end up using my house or whatever I have. So it's a program that, you know, we need to do more in the area of rehabilitation. In turn, you know, we've all talked about the trucking and stuff like that, you know, the amount of cars like that we get up at state, and if we would have closed the line down, it would have put about another 2,000 trucks on Highway 22 out here between Salem and state, and we know that road now being a freeway helps out considerably, but it is a lot more trucks on an area if you can avoid it. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do, is work with the trucking industry to shorten hauls to the railroad at reloads and stuff like that, to do our best working together as a partnership to accommodate everything.
You know, I've noticed over the last few years, I think there's been a change in relationship. In the past, it seemed to be very adversarial, but all of a sudden everybody's woken up to the idea that we were much better off to utilize the strength that each one of us had, whether it's rail or trucking. You think that, it sounds like you're indicating that, you believe that's happening also?
Well, we see it because we all see the problems you have with trying to go like up to Portland. I have people interested now that if you want to load out piggyback or containers, especially the people that want to move them up to Seattle, you have to truck it into Portland, into Swan Island, into that area, or up to those areas. And it's difficult because the roads are so congested. If they can load it down, say, in the Woodburn area at a reasonable price and then move it that way right through that area to Seattle, that's one of the things that we're looking at. So it's a combination of working together to lessen the impact on both ways. Thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? Well, we'll get to work on this because I think you folks have demonstrated that there's hope, that it isn't just wasteful to continue to try to keep the short lines alive, but literally we see a revival happening. And so anything this committee can do to help, these two are very competent, as you can tell, and so we'll look forward to them bringing us a plan.
Thank you.
Thank you again very much.
Thank you.
Is there anything further to come before the committee?
Nothing that I'm aware of, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Without any objection, we'll be adjourned.